Tuesday, the 22nd of February 2011. Members present are Representative Jewell, Representative Guttenberg, Representative T. Wilson, Representative Guerra, Vice Chair Faircloth Stoltz, Co-Chair Thomas, Representative Dugan, Representative Edwin, Representative Costello, and Representative Newman. We have full attendance of the committee. Anything to come before the committee before we start? Good. We kept the plane in the air long enough to welcome Representative Munoz. And we have before us House Bill 7.
So you went through the TSA check.
Welcome, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Stoltz and Thomas and members of the committee. Synthetic cannabinoids are materials that contain hallucinogenic chemicals that are sprayed on leafy plant material. The materials are marketed under a variety of names, including K2 and Spice, and are sold over the internet and in stores. The products are marketed as a synthetic marijuana or incense as a way to increase popularity, since other forms of packaging, such as on a piece of paper or on a sugar cube, would closely associate with LSD. K2 or Spice was first brought to my attention by a parent whose son experienced a serious adverse reaction. Within moments of inhaling the material, the young man experienced severe vomiting, loss of reality, inability to walk and talk, and violent outbursts.
In a letter
to me, he wrote, if I may just quote from his letter,
please.
I only had a small amount, and in less than 2 minutes, I was losing my perception of what was real in every way. I lost control of my legs, and I couldn't walk. I couldn't talk. I can remember thinking to myself that I wasn't going to come out of this craziness, and this might be how I end up dying. I remember telling my brother to call 911 and going to the hospital. Since we began working on the bill, many similar stories surfaced, and to date, many states across the country have enacted bans on this material. Synthetic cannabinoids are relatively new to the U.S. They are manufactured in China and Europe, but have been banned in many parts of the world, including Germany, Sweden, Russia, and England. The popularity in the U.S. is increasing, especially among youth, due to the easy access to the material, low cost, and the difficulty in detection on drug tests. The herbal and chemical compounds commonly produce a reaction similar to the use of marijuana. However, some users experience violent reactions, like I described earlier. HB7 would classify certain synthetic cannabinoids as Schedule 3 controlled substances. The original bill would have classified these substances as Schedule 2A, which include compounds that contain hallucinogenic substances. With the advice of the Department of Law, when we were in the Judiciary Committee, we amended the bill to a Schedule 3A category. Kendra Klaster is here to walk you through the bill and also to discuss the fiscal notes. And if you have any questions, either she or I are available. Thank you.
Representative Munoz, I noticed one of your prime co-sponsors sitting right behind. I'd like to recognize Representative Pruitt. He has got capital letters. That's a prime co-sponsor, right? Very good. Did you have any comments, Representative Pruitt? She's handling it, even. Very good. Good answer.
Please. For the record, Kendra Cluster, staff to represent Munoz. As Kathy stated, from the Department of Law and Legislative Legal, we went through a number of different things and vetting out to make it a Schedule 3 controlled substance. This is where other synthetic THCs are presently located within the schedules right now. When looking at the bill, I won't really go through it too much because you really need to be a chemist to understand all of those. As you look at that, I've got a number of questions. People call me going, what are you doing? But those are the different chemical compounds of the synthetic THC, which has come out from DEA and also working and looking at other states and looking at the research, and these are the ones that we have found to have the the harmful side effects and that have come to be prevalent in this K2 and spice product. This legislation has been supported by a number of different folks that have contacted us. The Anchorage Municipality, which has actually already done a ban on this synthetic substance. Fairbanks Police Department, Sergeant Robert Thompson has testified before, but he could not be online today since he has a training he has to attend all day. But he did provide a written statement, which should be in your packet. There's been some problems come out from the Fairbanks Police Department, who had an investigation of a motor vehicle accident where the driver was under the influence of this K2 product and was having seizures. Well, without this legislation, they're saying that you cannot violate as a DUI until this becomes a controlled substance. Other folks that have written to us, the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, MATSU, Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition, Alaska Peace Officers Association, Alaska Associated Chiefs of Police, Women Police of Alaska, and many constituents have been contacting us. I've even been stopped in the hallway here, and I've heard a number of different stories from people across the state. So if there are any other questions, I am available.
We do have some people that can speak in more coherent terms on some of these chemistry terms, if anybody wants it. So we have Oren Dim from the Crime Lab. He would probably preempt questions, I bet. I invited him forward by voice. Mr. Dim?
Mr. Chairman, I'm present.
Do you have anything to add on the bill, Mr. Dim? You're the only one here with a chemistry background.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here for questions if anyone has them.
Does anybody wish to make inquiries of Mr. Dim, Representative Guerra?
Thank you. Mr. Dim, this is Representative Wes Guerra. My only question is really whether this should be treated as marijuana or it should be treated as hashish, right? So that there's a different penalty level for the two separate drugs. And in your opinion, is the effect of this drug more like one or the other?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, not being a toxicologist, I'm really not overly qualified to talk about effects. I can talk from a chemistry perspective. These are synthetic compounds, meaning they have to be synthesized and made. They're not natural products, whereas marijuana, of course, is a plant material that naturally excretes tetrahydrocannabinol as a component. So they are definitely synthetic drugs or designer drugs. But as to whether or not they should be classified as marijuana or a 3 or a 2, that's about all the input I can give you on it.
We have Mr. Luck up here, who I assume was a drafter and has considerable expertise in criminal law, especially Title 11. That's probably – would you care to come forward, Mr. Luck up? I'm not going to try to have another Judiciary Committee meeting here, but if there is a relevant question. And before I go to Mr. Luckup, I failed to notice another prime co-sponsor, Representative Lynn, who's here for another bill. So, and I hope it was appropriate to bring you up. I want to have the best information possible. And there's reasons, I assume, why you drafted it accordingly.
For the record, my name is Jerry Luckup, Assistant Revisor of Statutes for the Alaska Legislature. The Judiciary Committee placed the synthetic THCs in with the other THCs that we have classified. We currently have classified in Alaska as Schedule 3 drugs. Natural THC, which is an active ingredient in marijuana, when it is derived from the marijuana. And we also have 3 synthetic THCs currently classified as Schedule 3. And the committee chose to, since these are all similar and they are all the same classification of drug, to place them all together in the same place.
Through the chair, what's the penalty for your first conviction?
It depends if your distribution and manufacture are felonies. It can be, there really isn't any difference between Schedule 1, 2, and 3 dealing with manufacture or delivery. There's slight differences in statutes, but those are all felonies. Possession can be either a felony or a misdemeanor, depending upon the amount. The dividing line is 3 grams. Below 3 grams is a misdemeanor for a Schedule 3. Above 3 grams is a felony under Schedule 3. When you go to Schedule 2, then they're all possessions of felony.
Hello, Representative Guerra.
How much is 3 grams in terms of, like, a joint size?
You might ask Mr. Din that.
The witness has no expertise on this issue. We will go to the folks at the drug lab there, crime lab, and the Alaska crime lab in Anchorage. Mr. Dim?
Through the chair, Representative
yes.
Barrett, a typical marijuana cigarette weighs in at about 0.3 grams or a third of a gram. So about three or so hand-rolled cigarettes to the gram, so about nine to ten hand-rolled cigarettes would be 3 grams.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
I got a question for Mr. Dim. If I may, can you tell me about the manufacture of this? Is this something that takes place from chemicals under the sink, or is it something that requires an organic product, or does somebody order chemicals from a lab, or how does this take place? Is this like a cooked product, or?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this is actually some pretty exotic chemistry. It does require a fair amount of skill, knowledge, and equipment to make these compounds. This is not a your typical backyard clandestine operation.
If I may, Mr. Chair. So where does most of this come from in the state? Is there a source? Is it able to track it back to someplace?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I have not done any work or research in that area. I believe previous testimony traced production to a couple of companies overseas.
Thank you.
Representative Newman, then Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I don't know who to direct this to, but I have a couple questions. Going back to the I think what Representative Guerra was going down that line of questioning is what is the sentencing in this? We've heard that it would be the equivalent of 9 cigarette styles, and I don't even know what this stuff is. I learned today from some work this morning about what this was from a gal working here. But so if they're in possession of 3 grams, what's the prison sentence for that? And I know that we heard a pretty extended sentence here, but I don't think I heard a time on that.
Mr. Lookout. Through the chair, Representative Newman. The penalty, the possible penalties for a Class A misdemeanor are up to 1 year in jail. For a Class C felony, the maximum sentence is 5 years, and there is no presumptive term for the felony, so usually a person can assume that if they're convicted of a Class C felony, they're going to receive something less than 1 year in jail.
So for 3 grams, then, you could get what is typically a sentence for 3 grams of marijuana? Do we know? I'm going to try and compare this to that as far as, and I think this is much more serious than marijuana from what I've heard, but I'm not trying to get an equivalent.
Department of Law and courts could probably give us more accurate information. There are some fiscal note questions. I had hoped to move this bill out, but our own legislative finance folks have raised some questions about the fiscal notes, and that's our main function here is the financial impact. So we'll have a mini judiciary meeting plus the fiscal note issue in the next one. But we will have questions on the fiscal note so we can point out some concerns. But all questions are going to be taken on this. They're all relevant, and so we will. I notice Ms. Carpinetti is in here. She might be able to add something if, but probably not. Anyway, we have a, we, whether either this meeting or the next meeting. So, Representative Wilson.
My question has to do, we were talking about DUIs and being able, police being able to stop them. How would testing go about to know that they should be testing for this being the issue versus drinking? How would a police officer be able to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Well, with the incidents that they had pulled them over, they did, you know, they went through a number of different questioning, and they did admit to smoking the K2 product. I think that when you're going to have to look at, I leave that up to the police and how they want to test that, but the things that happen to you while you're on this K2 is going to be a lot different than when you're going to be on alcohol, and they have had interactions with both. So with a gentleman that they had pulled over, he was having a seizure and hallucination. So the effects between alcohol and this are quite different. But I'll leave that up to the test. But as Representative Munoz did state, that our current drug testing right now does not pick up this. So that's one thing that they're going to have to look at changing, and they're more invasive right now to test for this product.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And this may go with the fiscal note. I know it's different. I guess what I'm just trying to figure out is that you have an impaired driver, so now you have to figure out from what. And so I maybe you answer that question that there's no, even if they went and had a blood test, there still may not be a way to distinguish that this was the reason they were under the influence of something besides alcohol. Is that true?
Mr. Lockhart.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's always a problem in prosecuting drunk driving to deal with the person that's driving under the influence of controlled substance, which is just as illegal. Prosecutors attempt to prove that through other things, the drugs that are found with the person, the way they were acting, blood test that was conducted at the time. In this case, there isn't necessarily a test that's going to reveal this material. And so there will definitely be problems. The reason the gentleman Fairbanks was able to admit that he had taken this was because it's not illegal. So he could admit to taking this, and yet he would not be committing a crime based upon taking this, other than possibly careless or reckless driving, which he was eventually convicted of, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. So we're basically prosecuting for having it on the person at this point until more is understood versus if they've already ingested it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you still have to prove to convict them of driving under the influence. They were under the influence of the controlled substance. It's a difficult prosecution any time the person is under the influence of a controlled substance. But it's not impossible to convict.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we get to finish the rest of the public? Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
Let me just state my concern. For a while, this legislature was making, I think, more things into felonies that should have been made into felonies. A misdemeanor is a serious crime. And sometimes the appropriate crime level to charge something. And I'm not always thrilled with adding nonviolent crimes as felonies. And so is there a way in this bill, and maybe it's how it was originally drafted, is there a way in this bill where you could charge somebody who sells a lot of this stuff as a felon, but somebody who has possession of not a lot of this stuff as a misdemeanor? I just don't want to make everybody a felon.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's what they, I believe, what judiciary tried to do is drop it down a level. So if you possess smaller amounts, it would be a misdemeanor. The distribution is always going to be a felony under a Class 3.
So the sale is always a felony.
Yeah, it's always going to be a felony under a Schedule 3. You would have to drop down another level. You'd have to drop down basically to 4A controlled substance to to provide that the sales would be a misdemeanor. You know, at that point, then it becomes somewhat problematic in that normal THC is of Schedule 3, and these other three synthetic THCs in law now are Schedule 3s also.
And on specific questions on the statements and general philosophies, we can save that for wrap-up.
Is there a way to leave the sale as a felony and have more than, let somebody have more than 3 grams as possession and still have that as a misdemeanor?
Through the chair, that yes, you know, we could always create another level in, for example, in fourth or fifth degree misconduct involving a controlled substance, and to specify a specific level for these synthetic THCs if you wanted to.
I don't have a substantial amount of criminal law experience, you know, 3 months I practiced. I do know that when something is a felony, it gets fought a lot harder. It's more likely to go to trial than when it's a misdemeanor. And I think we do have to take into account not just the fairness, but the cost of making something that might possibly be viewed better as a misdemeanor as a felony. I mean, it's got a cost to it. It's got a jail time cost to it. It's got a prosecution cost to it. And those are my thoughts right now.
And those are very appropriate questions. That's one of the reasons we're holding the bill, for those, make sure we accurately answer those fiscal note questions. So they're, I want to take the rest of the public testimony, and then we'll get to the general discussion, fiscal note discussion.
The preliminary. We have Kate Burkhart. I don't know if she's here or online. Well, it's a judiciary CS, so once you move this for adoption for consideration.
We'll take care of a little bit of housekeeping here.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move for in front of the body of the CS for House Bill 7 Judiciary 27-LS0044/T.
Without objection, that's the working document before us. So thank you, Madam Vice Chair, for keeping me straight. Ms. Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Kate Burkhart, and I am the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Before I share the board's comments, my usual disclaimer. The Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse was created by statute to advise the executive and legislative branches on issues related to substance abuse, alcoholism, and drug abuse. We are located within the Department of Health and Social Services. We do not speak for the Department of Health and Social Services. My comments this afternoon are solely representative of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse's position. We are in support of this bill. The chemicals at issue were created actually as part of a federally funded research project on the effects of THC on the human brain. They were created in a highly sophisticated chemistry lab. This is not something you make in a dorm room. And they were never intended for human consumption. And I think that that's very important. This, while it's applied to a natural product, this was never intended for human consumption. The reported effects of the substance are not similar to naturally occurring products like marijuana. In the record, there is testimony from a doctor here in Juneau about the symptoms which led to someone being admitted to the intensive care unit. The American Association of Poison Control Centers received over 3,000 calls about poisoning from this product last year and 400 calls just in January of this year. It's implicated in criminal activity. You've heard about DUIs here in Alaska. There's also been incidences of violent crime. The effects of this product involve a much more violent behavior than people usually expect from marijuana, hallucinations, There has been a death attributed to this product here in Alaska, and there have been at least one suicide and other suspected suicides linked to its use. It has potential social costs, not just in loss of life and injury, but also in admissions to emergency rooms. So the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse feels strongly that it should be regulated, and it should be regulated at a higher level than marijuana because its effects are much more severe. And again, this was never intended for human consumption. These products were created for research purposes to only be tested on animals, never for human beings. Thank you.
You may not be qualified to answer this question, but is this substance eligible for the medical marijuana statute that was created by initiative?
No, sir, it's not. It's not a naturally occurring product. It's a man-made product that is applied to a natural plant base.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you. So are there any accounts of this substance reaching out to rural Alaska yet, or has it been around the state so that the reports are sort of statewide in terms of impact?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the reports that we have heard about have all been in urban areas, and of concern to us is the extensive use in the military. The U.S. Army has banned the substance and has actually court-martialed over a dozen service members here in Alaska. The Navy's had the same problem, and given the fact that we also have National Guardsmen throughout Alaska, we are concerned that it might infiltrate into the bush that way.
Any other questions for Ms. Burkhart? Robert of Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Burkhart, would the bill suggest for any quantity of the following substances? Is there any other substances that have similar types of chemical structure? I know that we list here several different chemical structures. Is there any other similar drugs or substances that are common around that are similar in nature or structure that could be construed to be this?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, these are very specific chemical formulas with atoms and molecules. And so it would regulate five very specific chemical compositions. So things that could be created that would be similar because of the specificity of the bill would not be included. One thing that we appreciate is that the bill as it's drafted tracks with the temporary federal regulation that the Drug Enforcement Agency has enacted. So we are following in what 13 other states and now the federal government are planning to do to regulate this product. But a chemist could come up with something equally exciting slash harmful that has a different chemical composition that wouldn't be controlled by the bill. That's my understanding, but I'm definitely not a chemist.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Burkhart. Is there anybody here in Juneau wishing to testify on the bill that didn't sign up? Is there anybody online who wishes to testify on the bill? We'll close public testimony and go to the fiscal note discussion, preliminary. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, if we could have the sponsor back at the table for discussion.
Representative Munoz.
I'm not sure the sponsor can answer this, but the one death that occurred in Anchorage, and I have the unfortunate I am aware of one child that I know in my community that I believe has had the same bad ramification that was left, so that she was unable to move, and only through the grace of someone walking in and finding her was she taken to the emergency room and saved. So I'm supportive of the bill and just want to make sure that we get it right. That said, it appears there's only two labs nationally that can actually do the types of tests that we're looking at. One of the labs does urine analysis, and one does something with the blood. And so let's go for economic opportunity. If we were to look at your fiscal notes inside the state crime lab, I'm wondering if we could actually market something to be available to other laboratories across the state to help us fund our position, as well as to provide that safety net for Alaskans who might disclose that they're having a violent reaction. So I would just throw that out to the sponsor, that when we look at the fiscal note, we might be able to use the new state laboratory to provide an engine to actually help other states come into quantifying people taking the drug. Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Guerra's comments, I didn't ask to speak then, but this is a real safety issue. And so I would hope that anyone who was taking the drug that had an adverse reaction would acknowledge immediately that that's what's happening, that officers would ask those questions because they're having a reaction that's different than they anticipated, and that they should seek medical treatment quickly. So I hope that that's the case, and maybe someone could talk to us about that. But specific to the fiscal note, we have a correction fiscal note that Representative Munoz goes zero to almost $200,000 per person, it looks like. And I'm not sure how we straighten that out. It's fiscal note.
That is number
three. It's number two, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure who from corrections is here that can speak to the indeterminate amount that's listed, but it's not very helpful to the Finance Committee with that kind of a range per person. Someone needs to make a guess that's closer to accurate. Mr. Chairman, is there someone here from the Department of Corrections?
I haven't seen anybody from the department. I didn't see anybody signed in. That's...
So Mr.
I would have thought public safety would have been here, too. It's a major component. Well, they are. Who is there?
Well, they have different...
This ought to be an opportunity for public safety to try to make the crime lab more attractive.
Sue Stan Clough was taking notes when I was asking about economic opportunity for us. Ms. Munoz, if you could contact corrections on their fiscal note.
Chairman,
our staff will actually.
Sure. I would be happy to do that, and I agree with Representative Faircloth that it's vague. I mean, the fiscal goes from zero to $200,000, and it's very difficult to present legislation when you have a fiscal note that is this unclear. So we will try to pinpoint with the Department of Corrections more accurately the figures.
Legislative, Mr. Teal and Mr. Armstrong will be involved in this endeavor and seeking truth and accuracy. So we want it. Representative Costello.
Oh, I just wanted to also bring to your attention that some of the documentation is referred to as a Schedule 2A substance and others 3A, and I just wanted to, just for clarification, to make sure that that we see it as 3A.
Yes, the bill before you is, excuse me, through the chair, the bill before you, Representative Costello, is to change the law to include this substance under 3A. Originally, it was presented as a 2A substance, potentially a 2A substance, but that was amended in the Judiciary Committee.
And one other quick comment, Representative Costello, is that we are starting to get in some new fiscal notes that the reference is Schedule 3. Department of Law has sent one in. I just have not received one yet from the other departments, but we're working to get them to reference Schedule 3.
And I also wanted to mention, I appreciate you introducing this bill. At the time, in late last year, I was working with at-risk youth, and I received a phone call from a friend who said that if I get in the legislature, this has got to be something that we deal with, because it's hit the streets in Anchorage with a tenacity that we need to address. And so I just wanted to mention to you that I appreciate you introducing this, along with the other prime sponsors.
Thank you. Thank you. And in response to that, I appreciate the comment. And again, I was very moved by the testimony that I heard from people in my community, and motivated to help address the problem. And that's why we're here today. But I appreciate the comment. Thank you.
And I jumped away from Representative Faircloth before she was done with her persistent line of questioning. I'm sorry.
Actually, that was the correction, Mr. Chairman. If we could move to fiscal note number three. that has a $126,800 first-year fiscal note and then followed by $106,600. I was wondering if public safety could offer some insight. If we only have two places that are testing via blood and urine, what is the recommended way to test for this product, and then what do each of those tests cost, and how long is the period of time before we have results from that based on your fiscal note?
Would Ms. Stancliffe, would you prefer to talk now, or do you like some time to prepare a more insightful answer?
We've got Orrin Dam online. I can refer to him to the fiscal note or however you wish, Mr. Dam.
Mr. Dam?
Yes, thank you. Can I be heard?
Yep.
Hello?
Yep. You are heard and you can be heard.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, to answer your question, there are two testings. One would be toxicology, the testing of blood or urine for the presence of these drugs. The other is, in possession cases, the testing of the solid material. The Alaska State Crime Laboratory currently has no toxicology program for the testing of drugs in blood and urine. That is outsourced to the state of Washington. So we currently have no facility here to do that, and that is done through a grant from Highway Safety to pay for those samples. Some samples have been sent out through Washington. They actually subcontract out the work for the testing on these synthetic cannabinoids because there are only a few places doing it. On the case of solid dosage form or possession, that is where our fiscal note approaches, and that is the workforce necessary to handle the increased number of submissions and ensure that the laboratory maintains its rapid turnaround time that's expected on these cases.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Please proceed. Keep the floor so I don't take away from the accident.
Mr. Dim, what's rapid turnaround?
Madam Vice Chair, we find most drug cases here in the state are going from time of incident to court in less than 60 days, and in most times about 45 days. We are running 68% of our drug cases are being turned in less than 31 days, and we're trying to make sure everything does not exceed that 45 to 50-day window.
That's excellent turnaround time. Thank you. So the fiscal note in front of us, Mr. Dim, is that any contract money then for sending tests outside of the state to Washington? Is that included?
Madam Vice Chair, it does not include that. That for all driving offenses, that would be handled under our existing contract and grant money.
So the 480 cases that this particular fiscal net would support is to just test people who are identified with the product itself?
Madam Vice Chair, that's correct. Up to, we would be able to handle up to 480 samples without impacting or increasing the turnaround time.
So, Mr. Dim, that's we're only getting to the people who then are pushing it based on this fiscal note versus those who might see adverse safety implications to their own personal being?
Madam Vice Chair, I would comment that much of our submissions, while people are stopped for various DUI causes, it's a combination of a blood sample from them, but most of the times are also in possession of material. So there are two analyses being performed. One is the blood sample for DUI. The other is the bulk sample that they're in possession of.
Mr. Dim, if they drew blood on this particular person, and they were testing for alcohol, they wouldn't find out that the person had consumed the product that we're trying to ban. Is that correct?
Madam Vice Chair, that is correct. But I would add, when we draw blood, when we analyze blood alcohol samples, and we do that at the laboratory, if there is a reasonable consideration or cause for belief of impairment and the alcohol level comes back zero to very low, that sample is actually sent on for toxicology analysis under our grant.
Thank you. One final question, Mr. Chairman, on this fiscal note. I'm not sure, Mr. Dim, if you know this or if anybody in our audience knows, but do our local hospitals in communities across Alaska have the ability to run a toxicology test that would actually pull this particular product out of the bloodstream and be able to identify it for the person who had consumed it if they weren't conscious?
Madam Vice Chair, I don't have an exact answer for you. Given the relative rarity of expertise in the country right now on this material, I would be inclined to doubt it.
Mr. Chairman, that's all. I'm just thinking of the young woman that I heard the story from, that she was found unconscious and they didn't know what was happening, and it was only through another youth's identification that they had smoked something that they thought was marijuana that I knew anything about it. So I know the hospital had to run toxicology tests to see what was happening and what poison was in the bloodstream. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Dim. We have Representative T. Wilson and Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question kind of is a follow-up on that. Do we normally test for these substances, you know, when somebody's pulled over? Because, again, we're going to know they're impaired, but we're not going to know what they're impaired by, even if we know they're not drinking. So then we've narrowed it down to some kind of drug. When that was sent, would they automatically just test for absolutely anything?
Representative Wilson, what is typically done with toxicology samples is we first screen them for alcohol, then they go on for tox analysis. In the cases where the alcohol is coming back low to negative and the typical toxicology analysis is coming back negative, if there are signs of impairment, then that sample can sometimes, depending on the request of the officer in the prosecutor's office, is sent on for additional testing to look for these specific substances.
Follow-up.
And we just did have our first positive toxicology result come back.
Okay, and then since this is 480 that we're going to be sending out on a contract, can you estimate how much this will increase our cost going to Washington, assuming that all these would have to go there and be tested?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the fiscal note in the up to 480 samples is actually for possession cases, solid dosage sample materials that would come to our lab for analysis. On the toxicology side of the house, our contract currently covers up to 520 requests per year, and we believe there's enough room in that contract to cover potential DUI samples that'll come up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dim, on page 2 of the bill, you know, from 7 to 16, you're describing the various compounds as best you can. I assume that's what it is, and I assume that you know, you've tried to focus on exactly what they are. And in section 16, the last section, you talk about, the bill talks about, making sure that compounds or similar compounds are included, and it seems like you focused on specific definitions, and then you're trying to make sure that something doesn't sneak in. So if somebody changes the chemical formulation a little bit, but how far have you gone in describing the chemical? Is there anything else in the world that is, well, not in the world, but in you know, in the abuse, these chemicals and these products that we've included in this?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, Mr. Lepkop actually, I believe, was involved in writing that and included some very good verbiage at the top of the bill where he talks about geometric or positional isomers. So what we have are the core identified components that, if you will, chemists tend to play with different parts of. And the positional isomer statement really does take care of mostly similar items. It will put a little bit of burden on the laboratory, especially in court, as we say, contained, insert long exotic chemical name, a positional isomer of, insert long exotic chemical name, having to explain to a jury what a positional isomer is, but it will cover instances where these chemicals are rapidly modified by simply tweaking a little bit of the molecule. It's not going to cover a new drug that's designed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we focused just down the line on this drug? I mean, have you, you know, when you broaden out to include everything, have you included, let's say, aspirin or something that's in everyday usage? Probably not, but I just need to ask the question.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I believe that the language in the bill is specific to this class of what has been called synthetic cannabinoids and their very closely related cousins, if you will, other synthetic cannabinoids that could be manufactured that are very closely related to them.
Thank you.
Chairman, can I make a comment on that real quick?
If it's better than Representative Dugan?
Sure, it will be.
Sorry.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
I just wanted to, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I just wanted to point out that this is similar language that we have under a Schedule 3 drug as well. So we're kind of updating it by also putting it under this, or sorry, under the Schedule 2. So we're updating it as under a Schedule 3. So if we're looking at like an isomer, we're essentially taking out maybe like one molecule, which is having the same effect, the same product that it would have, but removing one molecule doesn't mean that it takes away from it. So by putting this language in it, we're altering it just slightly, that kind of covers it under there. I don't know if I'm explaining that very well, but I just want to know that we're kind of updating our Schedule 3 to make it similar to what the Schedule 2 language already has.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I'm also just making sure that something's not slipping in that we're making illegal that we don't want to as well.
Understand.
And to continue our chat about cannabinoids, Representative Dugan.
I am not now, nor have I ever used cannabinoids.
You didn't inhale them.
No. I did not have to say this, Mr. Chairman. Every time I heard that word, I remember that movie Tremors when the guy was being chased by the graboids. I just can't get it out of my head. I've got a problem with this fiscal note. I've got a problem, I guess, understanding this fiscal note, because Mr. Dim said that it's most likely not being produced here because it's not a backyard production kind of thing. Mr. Luckup said there's no test to measure this material, if you've been using this material. And again, Mr. Dim said that we only had one positive result so far from anything that we've sent out. So I take all of that and I take a $126,000 fiscal note, and I don't see how they compute. It seems to me that if it's not a very widespread use, then we don't need to add an entire person. And if it proves to be a widespread use, then we could add another person. But at this point, I'd be inclined not to add this person at all because I don't think we have the evidence that would support the work that would need to be done. So if Mr. Dim or anybody else has got...
Yeah. We are going to have a conversation between OMB, the chairman of the operating budgets, and my staff, and the sponsor, and we're going to flesh these fiscal notes out before they come back. And it's worthy to have the initial discussions, but if there are any other questions on the substance of the bill, I think we're probably better. Corrections is calling in, but I'd rather talk to them about an updated new fiscal note and with more accurate information. We probably wouldn't benefit a lot from hearing from them right now. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, my only thought is that every day that we're in the legislative session that there are sound bites that are taken away from different meetings, and I hope the sound bite today is that there's a harmful product in Alaska that apparently looks something like marijuana rolled, and that anyone who is inclined to risk smoking one of those products could have an adverse reaction that the soundbite is today, you know, please beware. There are reasons that these are controlled that we have controlled substances and uncontrolled, and you're risking your life at taking some of these products, and we want Alaskans to be safe. And so if it takes another day before we move it out of here to discuss a fiscal note, that's just fine, and it's the right thing to do, but that there are products in Alaska that can harm people, and we'd like people to take note today. So, again, thank you for bringing the issue before House Finance.
And I had hoped to move it out today, but we'd be if we didn't take on the responsibility of having our fiscal notes and corresponding budgets that we're going to be passing. We're not doing our main job here on this committee. I think it's unavoidable that we're going to have second judiciary committees, despite my desire not to. As a matter of fact, they're the ones that don't like us. I kind of like having them because we've got smarter people up here. See how long that takes to get downstairs. So with that, we're going to set aside this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we look forward to working with you on the bill. Thank you.
Well, we're going to come up with them. The bill's going to be back. So if you want to go ahead, Duff, quickly, and we'll.
It's just this, and it's up to the committee. I have no idea how many of these prosecutions are going to go along, and I don't want to slow down this bill. It seems like a bill that should pass fairly quickly. But obviously, if there are going to be prosecutions and then defense costs, I don't know if that warrants a fiscal note from the Department of Law or the Public Defenders or OPA, or whether we just add to their budget next year when we find out how many prosecutions there are. I don't have any strong feelings about that myself. And I can't remember what a normal practice is when we go through something like this.
I know the Department of Law has been following this. If they would have been jumping on it with a fiscal note, we'll have those conversations with the OMB and all the departments. So I think they had
a zero.
So, but we can we'll talk about this in the next meeting. I want to have we have several other bills. We'll have the full conversation on fiscal notes with better information next meeting. I'd like to invite Representative Lynn forward. Thank you, Representative Munoz. See you soon. That's Representative Lynn is going to be presenting House Bill 3. And Madam Vice Chair,
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill Number 3, State Affairs, before the committee, 27-LS0010/X, before the committee.
Without objection, welcome, Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the Finance Committee and you all hearing this bill today. By happenstance, the HB 3, the bill you are hearing today, has the same bill number HB3 as this committee considered last year and was subsequently heard on the House floor last year. But the bills, I can assure you, are very, very different. For one thing, for openers, today's HB3 consists of one paragraph section, while last session's iteration of HB3 ran 5 pages and 9 sections. And this bill today cuts directly to the chase. HB3 today deals only with those who are not citizens but are in fact in the United States and by extension Alaska and Alaska legally. Today a non-citizen can legally be in the United States with a passport or a visa or a green card or whatever that expires tomorrow or next week, but they go down to the DMV and they get a driver's license that lasts for 5 years. And get a license today for 5 years when your visa expires in only a week or two. And that doesn't seem to make much sense to me. The HB3 is really a very simple thing. It merely permits the DMV to issue a driver's license for less than 5 years to match the term of the non-citizen's legal presence document, like a visa. In other words, if someone's visa expires in 6 months, so too with a driver's license. And my staffer, Thomas Reichert, go over the line. There's HB3 and Whitney Brewster, I hope, I believe. Director V is here to answer questions, as is Jerry Luckup, assistant revisor. With that, any questions? I'll go straight to my assistant here.
Welcome. For the record, I'm Thomas Riker, staff for Representative Bob Lynn, and I would like to say, Mr. Chair, that Whitney Brewster is online. She's not in the room. So, members of the committee, through the chair, determining how long a foreign national can stay in the United States is the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, not the state of Alaska. So we want to make sure that we're not issuing official documentation that contradicts the ruling that the federal government has made. As Representative Lynn mentioned, HB 3 puts an end to this contradiction by allowing the DMV to issue driver's licenses for less than 5 years when someone's authorized length of authorized stay in the United States is less than 5 years. Under HB 3, if a person has been admitted to the U.S. for a period of less than 5 years, their driver's license would expire on the same date as their legal presence. If their authorized length of stay is indefinite, their driver's license would expire after 1 year, and they would have to renew it every year annually after that until they receive a definite length of legal stay. However, in the State Affairs Committee, we did work with the Division of Motor Vehicles to make sure that if someone does have to renew annually, that the fees will be waived up to 5 years, and that they'll also be able to do that by mail up to 5 years, so that it's not overly burdensome on people who have an indefinite length of authorized stay. We wanted to draft this bill in the simplest, most straightforward way possible. We didn't want it to be too burdensome for DMV, which is why we don't mention ID cards. ID cards are controlled through regulation, and DMV, it's their intention, if this bill is passed, to set the same rules for ID cards as are set for driver's license, but they need additional statutory authority to issue driver's license for less than 5 years. They believe they already have the statutory authority to do that for ID cards. So I just want to end by saying that I think it's important to note that this does not change how people go about giving driver's license. It just changes the length for which that license is issued if they're in the United States legally for less than 5 years. And it also doesn't require anyone to offer proof of their authorized length of stay to get a driver's license. However, if they do use a visa or a passport or some other immigration document as their identification when they initially go in for a driver's license, then the length on their driver's license would be tied to their authorized length of legal stay. So I want to thank you all for your time. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. And as Representative Lynn mentioned, we have Jerry Luckup and Whitney Brewster for you as well.
We're going to grant a pardon here. No, I am. That person, I think the person was thoroughly embarrassed enough. I think that's it. And, yeah, we do have a donut rule if your cell phone rings, and I see the person was foreign to our land. And I took that... my role is, I think that's in the uniform rules. I did it.
Clemency.
I can concur that it's okay. Wave white donuts.
No, no.
I think you don't actually wave.
And Mr. Ford from the Department of Law very generously provided some there. Anybody can help themselves to. So please proceed.
I believe at this point, Mr. Chair, we're just open to questions from the committee.
Representative Wilson, Guerra, then Faircliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, how would it work by mail? Do they have to send a copy of something and to extend it? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, my understanding is that when you initially get your driver's license or ID, you would have to do that in person, but it's the renewals that you could do by mail. And I believe because we're dealing with, you know, authorized length of stay, they would have to send some copy of immigration documentation. My understanding is that generally, if you have an indefinite length of stay and immigration extends your authorized length of stay, you'll receive a letter or some other form of communication from them, and that would be sufficient for DMV to issue you another license.
I mean, we're not really talking about immigrants here through the chair. We're talking about visitors to the United States, which the visa covers. They're just visiting.
Follow up, I think.
I wasn't confused till then.
I just want to make sure, for instance, if I took a document and they gave me 2 years, that I couldn't just by mail keep getting 2 years without providing some other kind of documentation saying that I have now been authorized to stay 2 more years.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's right. They would have to send in new documentation that has a new date of authorized stay, or at least extends the indefinite period for whatever length of time.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thanks. Representative Wynn was polite enough to come to me to talk to me about the bill before the hearing. And I'm just remembering back to last year's debate and sort of the nub of what I think the big part of the debate was last year. And I was, what happens if you're somebody who is here, you have a valid application for immigration status because you're a victim of domestic violence? That was the example that was used last year. So you're here, you don't yet have a visa. You have a valid application in with the INS for a visa because you're a victim of domestic violence. Under this bill, you could not get a driver's license. Is that correct?
I believe you get a driver's license under this bill, but for the period of time you authorized to stay here, it probably would be indefinite. And in that case, you would get it for a year. Am I correct?
Through the chair, that's my understanding as well.
Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
But I think if you've applied and you don't have legal status, I don't think you have any authorized period to stay here. So under that circumstance, I don't think it would be indefinite.
Did the witness say the default was a year? I just heard that.
Through the chair, if your status, indefinite is a little misleading. We ran into this in state affairs as well. The INS or whatever the Department of Homeland Security agency is never going to say, okay, stay here indefinitely, whenever you decide to leave, go for it. So it really might be better to say pending, and I think the situation you're talking about would fall into that category as well. If you can document that you've started those proceedings, that you have applied for that status, that would be sufficient for DMV, but it would only be for a year, so you would have to show at the end of a year's time that, your status had been adjudicated.
Just through the chair, then the language right now is you get the license for your authorized stay, and you don't have an authorized stay while you have an application. And when you have an application, and you're illegal until you get the authorization. So I think that language, it would have to be changed if you intend to cover folks who have a valid application. And no.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, and I don't want to speak for Representative Lynn here, but I think we'd be okay with changing.
Fire Hardy.
I think the conclusion we came to in state affairs is we would be okay with changing indefinite to pending if that works better for you. And I think that might address the concern that you're raising.
Through the chair. But then I would say your authorized stay is pending. And the point is you don't have an authorized stay as long as you have an application out. You have no authorized stay. So I think you'd have to use different language.
Right.
I don't know what that would be.
Change it back to endeavor.
But it would have to be something other than authorized, because you're not authorized yet.
Yep. We'll go through some more questions. Some of these may be answered by Ms. Brewster, who probably has been playing around. Just the folks that are in queue, do you mind if we go to Ms. Brewster first? Ms. Brewster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here.
Have you been listening intently and heard all the questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster. I'm the director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. To address specifically.
And you can start with any summary statement you had on the legislation first before jumping into questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That would be wonderful.
I'm here to make your life easy.
HB 3 allows the DMV to promulgate regulations to shorten the length of time that we issue a driver license for. There is a zero fiscal note attached to this legislation. It would not impact the DMV's existing procedures, other than we would expire the license at a different time than the standard five-year period. Currently, the DMV requires for an original license proof of legal name, date of birth, and social security number if one exists, and the resident address. For immigrants, this is typically they will present us with a permanent resident card. And for our international visitors, this would typically be a passport with an accompanying visa. We see those documents now. This would simply expire the license with the legal document expiration. I think it's really important to note that the DMV receives letters from the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services on a regular basis, which are honored by the DMV. That would not change under HB3, as we would continue to honor notifications from Citizenship and Immigration Services that an individual's legal stay has been extended. Specifically to address Representative Vera's concern about individuals who are victims of sex trafficking or domestic violence, there is a specific category for individuals who claim that they are victims, and they are granted legal stay temporarily while their case is being investigated. So, to address whether or not they are legally here, the Customs and Immigration Services, as well as law enforcement, is familiar with the process of people who state that they are victims. They then put them in a very specific category and treat them differently than, let's say, your typical individual who may or may not be in the country legally. And so I just wanted to expressly state that. I did meet over the summer with the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, as well as Immigration and Custom Enforcement regarding this particular topic, and feel satisfied that these individuals are indeed protected and would not face immediate deportation. And with that, I'm happy to answer any other questions that the committee has.
Okay, we'll go on to Representative Fairclough and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I believe I was at the meeting with Ms. Brewster over the summer. Is that the meeting you were referring to, Whitney?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, that's the exact meeting.
Thank you. On pursuit of someone who wasn't supportive in the last legislative session about what was before us for the issues that were raised by Representative Vera today, I met with law enforcement as well as from the federal government, as well as those who bring people in immigration that allow legal paperwork. They assured me that if there was a victim of domestic violence, sex trafficking, if they were to appear at DMV, DMV's personnel have been trained to point them in the right direction, and that visa or temporary approval from the federal government to be a valid resident of the state would be issued, certainly for a tentative period, but immediately upon that consideration. And we were told at that particular meeting that the longest that would take, if that happened, would be 24 to 48 hours, depending if it was a Friday night or if something happened over a weekend. So that particular issue, from my perspective, has been managed now through the work of Ms. Brewster in establishing that communication with immigration, both on the enforcement side and the education side. That said, I have two questions. First, could you tell me why State Affairs changed the language from shall to may? And then I'd like to know from the Department of Law the definition of for the record and for posterity's sake, if it comes up again for us, what the definition is of indefinite in regards to this legislation. So the first question for staff is, what's the difference between this version and the original introduction, and what was the reasoning that State Affairs thought that this change should be made?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, there was some concern that basically DMV's concern with the original statute was that the five-year length of time is laid out in statute. They're not just authorized, as with ID cards, to promulgate regulations. And we didn't want to, in this bill, be restrictive of them again and be coming back to this 5 years from now and them saying, here's this other eventuality that we've reached. We don't feel like we have the power to promulgate regulations to get around it because the statute says shall rather than may. That was a concern that was raised by some members of State Affairs. As far as the perhaps more substantive changes in the bill, again, there was concern, particularly from Representative Seaton, that this would be overly burdensome on people who had an indefinite or pending or duration of status, length of authorized stay. So from the original version, we did add the language that authorizes the department to waive their renewal fees and to allow them to renew by mail up to 5 years. But that was the main substantive change between the two bills from the original version and the State Affairs Committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, it's not really a follow-up, but I have both bills in front of me. And so Representative Lynn and his co-sponsors originally provided, if a period of authorized stay is indefinite, the department may not issue issue the license with a validity of greater than a year. So the whole premise was they could issue a license for a month, 2 months, 5 months, 6 months, but no more than a year or up to a year. And now it says we're going to just give everyone a year's license, even if we know they should only be here for a month, 3 months, 6 months, or 9 months. So I just bring that to your attention. If that's our intent, that wasn't the original. We actually made it definite that everyone gets one for a year. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct, Representative Faircloth. And I thank you for bringing that to my attention because I had forgotten that we made that change. The issue there was that privately we had contacted immigration, and the answer that we got from their liaison for the state was that generally when people do have this wavering status, they will receive roving updates extensions of 30 days, 90 days, 30 days. And so we didn't want someone who was in the midst of that process to have to come back and get a new license every 30 days. And we also didn't want the department, if they were going to waive the fees, to have to take on the cost of issuing them a new license every 30 days. So since that's the Department of Homeland Security's normal operating procedure, we figured let's just make it a solid year for everybody, but make sure that at the end of that year period, we're verifying that they are still allowed to be here.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. So I appreciate that particular response and the discussion in State Affairs, but the real issue is we probably should allow the flexibility and not the mandate, which is what the department has been bringing to our attention over the last 3 years. They need the flexibility to say if someone is coming in. Right now, we've just mandated a year when we may have someone present themselves that would be unlike domestic violence or other type of person, but a person that has papers that are expiring in 30 days. And why would you, if they were expiring in 30 days, why would you issue for another year? That's, I thought, was the intent of the bill, was to match licenses. So I'm not opposed to your language. I'm just pointing out that it addresses one issue in that we certainly don't want the person who has applied for a valid stay in the U.S. to have to go through a 30-day hurdle every 30 days in the department to do that. But if you know someone's paperwork is expiring now, you've just went back and instead of making it 5 years, because that's all we would allow them to do before, you've mandated and you've lost them the opportunity to have discretion on now just giving them a year. So that's my that settles that particular issue. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like on the record for history's sake a definition in relation to the CS for HB 3, a definition from the Department of Law on what indefinite means in relationship to this documentation.
We have, would you like that right now? We've got somebody in line for this. That'd
be great.
Mr. Johansson?
Hi. Hello, Chairman. This is Erling Johansson, Assistant Attorney General in Anchorage. My understanding in reviewing this bill is that the term indefinite means non-finite term. So as we talked about earlier, if there's an application pending or if there is a continuing authorization, those would both be examples of non-finite term.
Other way?
I don't know, for Mr. Chairman, for Webster's, it seems like indefinite means it just goes on and on and on, and that's not the definition that's being presented to us. The definition presented to us is there's something pending, and we're waiting for someone else to take an action to actually tell us when the definition ends. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is, I would agree with that interpretation, but I would also say our you know, Webster's real world working definition of indefinite was just not definite. So if it is pending, if it is up in the air, then it's indefinite. But I understand, you know, that it could be interpreted also to mean, you know, in perpetuity. So
for the record, your name was, as you jumped in between the other legal expert.
Sorry, for the record, my name is Thomas Riker, staff for Representative Boblin.
Representative, do you have something on this point, Representative? Or, Representative Gettenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Admin's got a zero fiscal note because the place will pay for themselves, I assume. But I'm just wondering if Ms. Brewster's online, training of BMV employees, and is this going to take a – what is this going to take to familiarize them with documentation, and is it going to take a phone call to INS or some system where they're able to get online, or what's that going to take? I mean, it seems like there's a component about that. Somebody comes up to the counter at DMV and says, I want a driver's license. Here's my documentation for whatever it is. Those people have not been doing this at all. So it's a whole new system of documentation, a whole new series of things. I'm just wondering how she's prepared to address that in the department.
Sounds good, Ms. Brewster. You have been doing this process of educating yourself, so I would assume you'd be absorbing this through your existing network. But I'll let you answer that yourself, as I've led you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Mr. Chairman, you are correct. The DMV is currently receiving immigration documents, passports, visas, permanent residence cards. We see a number of different documents at our front counter. So there would not be a substantial change from our current processes. What is changing is that we are now expiring the license with the date on those documents, which will take some training, but not an insurmountable amount of training, and can be absorbed in the DMV's current budget. I might also add that we do have a very strong relationship with the United States Customs and Immigration Services Office. If there are questions regarding documents, we have no problem calling and getting someone to help us look at a document. So that we do have a strong relationship, and I don't foresee that relationship changing anytime soon.
Representative Gettenberg?
I'll save my question. Thank you.
Representative Edgman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Ms. Brewster. I represent communities like Sandpoint and King Cove and Accutan, Alaska, that this bill may impact in a way that might not have been contemplated. But perhaps the discussion in the prior committees did consider communities of with seafood processors of that nature. But just a general question, Ms. Brewster, can you address somebody who might be in one of those communities? Alaska, for example, has a DMV that's available part of the year. Accutan doesn't have a DMV office. And King Cove and Sandpoint, I'm not quite sure if they have year-round services. I don't think they do.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, you are correct. Of the communities that you listed, the only community with a DMV is Unalaska, which is open year-round. I don't see a substantial change occurring in our offices in these areas where there are a number of cannery workers, for instance. To get an Alaska driver's license, the requirements are in statute, and those have not changed. an individual would have to show proof of legal name, proof of date of birth, a social security card if one exists, and a proof of residence address. Those requirements will not change. So I really do not see a significant impact on the outlying areas other than an individual's license will expire sooner than 5 years if they have a legal document that indicates their period of legal stay.
Okay, thank you.
Standing around, I'd like to get the, we have one more person from the public. I'd like to give him his couple of minutes to testify. At least there may be others, but there's one written here. Mr. Mittman. Take a couple of minutes.
Sure. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Mittman with the ACLU of Alaska. We provided written testimony to the committee, thinking that would be the most helpful. Our concern, as outlined in the testimony, is the potential for differential treatment of immigrants, and we believe those raise constitutional issues, specifically equal protection issues. Essentially, what's being instituted potentially is a sort of second-class type of license, whereas most individuals who receive a license for 5 years, immigrants who are a suspect class under most federal discrimination law are being given a different kind of license. If this term of stay had anything to do with their safety or ability to drive or anything related to the DMV mandate in issuing licenses, there could be a reasonable government interest in providing this differential class of license. Given, however, that the purpose of the driver's license is to determine who is a safe driver, it raises significant concerns that we believe a court would look askance at. With that, I will answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Mittman? Representative Guerra?
My question is for Mr. Mittman and Mr. Johansson, just so just to follow up on Representative Fairclough's discussion on this authorized stay language. So I guess maybe I'll ask the Department of Law first and then Mr. Mittman second.
Why don't you ask Mr. Mittman and then while he's on here testifying.
Okay. The concern I have is somebody who has a valid application in for immigration status or a valid application in for legal presence in the United States. So they don't yet have legal presence. The bill says it's okay to get a driver's license if you have an authorized stay. So is somebody who has a valid application in for legal presence covered by the authorized stay language? So that's my question.
Mr. Mittman.
The chair. Representative Garrett, we do believe this is, there are some language problems with the bill, and you've identified a significant one. And again, the issue that it raises is that you are now putting a state DMV agency in the position of making determinations that are best made by a federal INS or immigration agency. So it's an open question. It really does not, again, have to do with this individual's ability to safely drive a vehicle or understand the road laws. So it raises issues that are highly problematic. And, again, you're denying an individual who could very well be entitled to a license the ability to obtain it under procedure that all other individuals would be entitled to.
Any other questions for Mr. Mittman? Thank you. Oh, Representative Fairclough. We'll come to Mr. Johansson next.
Mr. Mittman? In the legislation before us, do you see any reference specifically to the immigration issue?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, the issue is an individual's length of stay. When introduced, there was information provided that many states have lawful presence requirements, and clearly a number of states have found that they can constitutionally implement those sorts of requirements. However, when you begin to provide differential types of licenses, I think the reasonable assumption is that it has to do with immigration status. Again, there's language problems. Presumably, every United States citizen is able to stay in the United States for an indefinite period, that is, until their death. But presuming that the intention is to provide differential licenses to those who may not be citizens or lawful permanent residents, the presumption is that a majority of these would be in some sort of immigrant status.
One follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mittman, what I've heard the issue actually as from the Department of Motor Vehicles state, they are explicitly required to issue a license for 5 years, and there are cases that present themselves outside of immigration issues that are reasons why they might want to limit a driver's license. And I was pursuing this during the interim to try to meet that need. And while this law before us is taking a step to meet that need, I have a piece of legislation that's been introduced along the same lines that is, again, just trying to offer the flexibility to the DMV to issue a license for a different period of time than 5 years.
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, again, this is one where, of course, the devil is in the details. Certainly, there could be a constitutionally appropriate and non-discriminatory reason for having a differential license. The concerns that are raised by this billing are then that as it is drafted, it certainly seems susceptible to discriminatory treatment that could be violative of federal constitutional standards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, sir. My understanding is these driver's licenses will be the same look. The only difference will be is when they expire. And they will have the potential, as they are allowed to stay here longer, of having that increased up to the 5 years for no cost. So I guess I'm not understanding, and I can understand if it was red or blue or green, so as soon as they took it out, it said something different, but everybody in this room has a different date on their driver's license, so I guess I'm having a hard time understanding why only the date being different that you have an objection.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you raise an important point, and there have this change that was made in state affairs that sort of lessened the burden on renewing the license, I think, headed in the right direction. So the differential treatment is that if you or I, presuming we're lawful citizens of the U.S., are entitled to a five-year license, we get our license and then we're done. There's no additional burden. Given that if you can renew by mail with no additional cost, the burden is significantly lessened, and I think the committee substitutes an improvement on the prior bill. The differential treatment is that there is a more of a process, more of a burden on an individual who could be in immigrant status. Additionally, there is the issue of which individuals are being required to provide which documentation. In the process, in the regulations, is there a level of discretion where a DMV employee might look at an individual who, quote-unquote, looks like an immigrant and require differential documentation than they might have somebody who does not, quote-unquote, look like an immigrant?
I'm puzzled, too, Representative Wilson. I don't see any other questions for the witness. Is there Representative Jewell?
I'm not even sure I know how to formulate this, but I guess maybe the shortcut is just to simply ask whether or not, if you're a citizen of the United States, you have a little bit more of an advantage versus when you aren't. And I'm not even sure that's the right question here.
Through the chair, Representative.
I don't know if that was a question.
I think you raised an important question, and that is there are clearly instances where individuals who are citizens have certain rights or privileges or opportunities that non-citizens do, and these have been found constitutionally permissible. The question here is a driver's license, the right to operate a vehicle on the roads, one of those rights that the federal government would find appropriate to treat an immigrant differentially? We believe not. Obviously, there's going to be differences of opinion.
That's what we legislate, you litigate. So, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that fine point, is a driver's license a right or a privilege?
Through the chair, there's actually interesting Alaska case law, which we reference in our written testimony. In many states, the right to drive is considered a privilege. However, once the state institutes policies or procedures, processes for providing that privilege.
Mr. Chairman, just for, again, history's sake, I would just like to put on the record that I believe driving is a privilege in the state of Alaska, and that you have to do things to obtain that privilege.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Just real short. It is the last question, because I think the issue here is if we used our driver's license just for driving, we probably wouldn't have this discussion. But because it's used as a legal document for many other things, whether that you agree or disagree, that's what causes, in my opinion, to be a problem. It's not just the privilege of driving. We also use it for a legal document and many other things, and therefore you don't have to show all those other documentation.
We're done. We're done. Is there any other public testimony? Here in Juneau or online? Hearing none, public testimony is closed.
Chair, I still have a question for
Mr. Chair. He's certainly one of our expert witnesses. Mr. Johansson, are you still online and prepared for a question?
Yes, Chairman, I am.
Okay, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Johansson, my only discomfort with the bill that I can think of right now is this authorized stay language. So the hypothetical is that you're here in the United States, you're fleeing persecution from your home country. Let's say you're fleeing persecution in Libya, or you're fleeing a domestic violence situation. So you come here, you apply for legal status because you're entitled to legal status if those things are true. You haven't received your approval yet. Are you allowed to get a license under the authorized stay language of this bill, or does that language have to be amended some?
Mr. Johansson.
To the chairman, to Representative Guerra, my understanding, based on your hypothetical, that the person from another country is in our country legally, is that if they have trouble establishing who they are here, they can present themselves to the appropriate federal agency, even here in Anchorage, and within either the same day or within a day or so, be handed the equivalent of a temporary authorization or an application pending paperwork, which I understand the DMV would accept under this statute. My understanding is in part based on a meeting that I was in also earlier this year with the federal agencies in the state.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have to ask the question to the director of DMV now.
Ms. Brewster, are you still online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Whitney Brewster, director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. It is my understanding that under this legislation, that if someone had gone to United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, applied for legal status, they were given a pending letter, the DMV would issue a license under this bill for a year as required in the indeterminate section of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Brewster. I'm happy with that if that's your commitment to me that person will get will be able to get a license under that circumstance. So that's the commitment we have from the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that is my commitment to you.
No other questions. We have the fiscal note, which I believe is a zero fiscal note, as we've it was a public testimony. The fiscal note has been thoroughly described in that it's they're going to handle this with existing personnel and will not have an impact requiring more money. So that fiscal note is before us. It will be part of our is there any other closing? Well, we'll go ahead and make a motion and see if anybody objects. But
Thomas.
And thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move from Committee CS for House Bill Number 3, State Affairs, Version 27-LS0010/X, with the company fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Hearing none. That bill passes from committee.
Thank you very much.
We're going to see if we can get, we're going to invite as soon as Representative Lynn and staff, and thank you for your work on this. And it's as complicated as it seemed this year, this was a lot easier than last year.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your interim work. Thank you, folks that were online testifying as well. Mr. Davis, we'll give it a shot.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Davis.
You're here for In God We Trust, right?
Yes. I'm here on behalf of I'm the Economic Development Officer with the Alaska Economic Development Authority, which is coming in as ADA. The bill before us is HB 119, which is a bill that proposes to modernize the agency. Quickly, what it does is it allows ADA to have the same procurement provisions as now enjoyed by the other public corporations in the state, which would include Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Secondly, it would permit ADA to own a percentage of a project it might develop through the means of a corporation or an LLC. At present, last year, the legislature allowed ADA to own a percentage of a project, but as we use that provision, we obtained information from the Department of Law that we could not be a member of an LLC because the percentage did not clearly provide that power, so we seek that clarification in this legislation. Secondly, we seek to expand the type of projects that ADA can do. Right now, ADA can do natural resources, energy, tourism infrastructure, and industrial development. As we've used these statutes, we were provided the opportunity to invest, for example, in a healthcare facility that would be leased to the federal government. Department of Law told us that we were not authorized to do a health clinic in rural Alaska. We also were approached by the Coast Guard for construction of facilities for the Coast Guard, which we would build and lease back to the Coast Guard again. The opinion was that we could not do a federal facility. By saying that, I'm not being critical of the Department of Law. If you look at our powers right now, they are limited to those four items. So we're seeking to expand them so that we can do more types of projects. The other expansions would be for community public purpose, transportation, or prototype commercial applications. We did a survey of other economic development authorities throughout the United States and noticed that most of them have the ability to support new technologies or new prototypes as a way to use state development capital to promote diversification of state economy. So, and the final one is it would add a clarification of that we could do roads. The reason we've added roads is the statute now clearly lets us build a road to a natural resource development. The example would be the DeLong Mountain Transportation Corridor for Red Dog. But that's connected directly to that. The question is whether we could do an industrial road that might not directly line up with the project. We think if we can get revenues from that road, we would do so. The caveat there is anything we build on transportation or roads would have to pay for itself. It would have to be a project that was bondable and would have to be a project that would meet economic development goals so that it could not be used generally for transportation, which was an issue one of the members had of this committee.
Before we go too far, Representative Lindmer, just out of courtesy, I wanted to let you know that I don't think we have a chance of getting to House Bill 19. If you're equally fascinated with this, you're welcome to stay and listen to us. And we'll wait for the floor. But didn't Mr. Davis.
That was the conclusion of remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Let's go through the formality. Representative Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move in front of the body CS for HB 119 EDT 27-GH1745/M. That could be an I, Mr. Chairman. I can't see on the one. It's a 1754, just for clarity.
Hearing no objection, that the previously recommended document is the working document for this committee. Questions for Representative Guerra?
Thank you. Mr. Davis, let me ask you the most explosive question first. And this is the one that you and I had talked about in the hallway. At some point, we're going to have a discussion in this committee probably about the Kinnickarm crossing. Not totally looking forward to the debate on that, but my understanding from you is that, or is my understanding correct that this legislation would not allow ADA to underwrite and fund something like the Kinnickarm crossing?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I do not believe it would. The present bonding limitations of ADA given its reserves right now would be in the range of $250 million to $300 million for any particular project, and I believe that the bridge is far more expensive than that. Secondly, our intent here is to do economic development projects so that the transportation of the roads we might build are going to lead to a particular economic development project that is tied to one of these purposes. And not to a general transportation intermodal system.
Just two follow-up questions.
Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
And this has to do more with a Christmas tree amendment that I would only add if other people were interested. Last year we passed SB 220, and that was the Omnibus Energy Bill. And in that bill we created a revolving loan fund, and that was intended to help private businesses upgrade the energy efficiency of those businesses. We've done this for public buildings and schools, but this was a revolving loan fund for private businesses. My understanding is that in the rush towards the end of session, we ended up putting that revolving loan fund under ADA, but not under the Alaska Energy Authority, which sort of more properly governs energy efficiency matters. Would you have any objection if we moved the revolving loan fund over to the Alaska Energy Authority?
Representative Chair, it's my understanding it should be an AA, but if it wasn't, then I think it belongs in AA. We are not concerned with the energy conservation efforts being done by our sister agency.
And then just the third question, Mr. Chair, why procurement is always sort of, for some reason, raises a lot of tempers, and it seems like you want to be exempted from the state procurement code, unless I'm misreading that. So how come and why is that a good idea?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, we're not, it's not a total exemption. What this does is it says that when you're doing a development project, like with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, we could develop regulations adopted by the Board of ADA, which would provide for a public process to do that. What that means is if you disagree with the procurement, you want to file a protest, you would file it with the Board of ADA and not through the Department of Transportation or the Department of Administration. That's going to be a faster process and probably a process more aimed at the protest, which is that you're going to the board which has expertise about what they wanted to purchase versus you're taking it to an agency that isn't familiar with the whole process. So I think having represented big protesters in private practice, I think this streamlined system is not only better for the agency, but it's also better for the people who want to file protests.
Before we go on, though, we have your boss online, Mr. Leonard. Did you have any comments? And I see a yes on wishing to testify. Mr. Leonard.
Yes, to the chair for the record. My name's Ted Leonard, and I'm the executive director. In reality, I think that Mark Davis has fairly presented what we're trying to do with this bill. And again, just to stress that it is looking at a way to provide more tools so that it can be more effective with working with the private sector in development projects. And pretty much that's the whole essence of this bill, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Leonard. Representative Wilson, did you have a question, Holden? There was somebody else. Oh, Representative Newman. You don't look like Representative Wilson there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry for insulting Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mark. I like this type of legislation. We did talk about changes in procurement code in this, and could you talk a little bit more about the sideboards that are involved with this? Because on page 2, section line says, notwithstanding other provisions in Alaska Administrative Procurement Act and procurement codes, what are your basic sideboards on this amount of maximum funding that's available and such?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the reference at line 11, page 2 of the bill is to AS 363170B, and what that bill provides for persons who bid to be licensed, business licenses, to show proof of doing business in the state. So we would still require all those criteria. Also, the other things, this is dealing with procurement for our development finance, essentially, so that if the agency is going out to buy computers or desks or the normal processes, it's going to do a bit out. Also, this does not mean that we would not change the prevailing wage requirements, so that would still apply to this procurement process. So that's kind of the sideboard for this provision.
Mr. Newman.
Is there a maximum amount of money that can be spent by ADA to develop a corporation?
Mr. the chair, the limits we have really are how much cash we have available for a project, and that can vary with what's in the reserve. Right now, I think the board has to also approve it, so that's another constraint in our agency. So even if we propose putting X number of millions of dollars, we have to have an open process with the board to do that. And like I said, our buying authority is probably in the range right now of a maximum of $250 million. Additionally, we have to come to the legislature for any bond over $10 million. And we also have to seek permission from the local community for any bond over $6 million, that is, have a local authority agree with our project. And finally, we have a $400 million limit in any given year on the number of bonds we can issue.
Glad to hear you have at least $150 million. When we're looking at project in Section 6, we have some definitions. Plant facility used intended for collection, processing, preparation, transporting, and other. Would manufacturing fall in on that? Because I know that when you're looking at different development plants and developing our resources, that could be part of that. Would that be intended to be part of what your meaning is on that?
Representative Chair, ADA was formed as an industrial development authority originally, and it's always been aimed at trying to create job development, alleviate unemployment, is right in the powers, and it's beginning 010, 44-88-010. So, yes, if the manufacturing is available, that's certainly one of our goals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple of questions. The first is, you said there's a limit on the amount that the agency can bond. What's the cash limit?
Representative Diggins, through the chair, there's two ways to look at the cash limit. First, under the Loan Participation Program, which is also part of ADA, that is capped by statute, no more than $20 million per loan. And how much the agency could invest in a particular project would be based upon its cash reserves and or coming to the legislature for bond. So that could be in the range of 0 to $10 million. But again, if it's $6 million or more, it must go to the local governmental authority and have a public hearing. It also has to file a finance plan. And again, also, to show us how we work, this is a public corporation, so we have to have all the members of the board have to agree to the project. So this, the management can't just pull the trigger.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. Comment. The part of this bill that troubles me a little bit is about limited liability corporations. And I understand there are legal definitions in terms of how they would work. But I'm concerned with the question of whether or not ADA forms a limited liability corporation. The project goes belly up. and somebody's left holding the bag, whether or not the state is actually held harmless in that situation, in fact, as well, both in law and in fact. Could you speak to that?
First, in dignity of the chair, I can. There's a couple of responses. First, ADA's bonds, if it issued a bond for a project, are not the moral obligations of the state by statute, and this does not change that. So that any recourse back on a bond goes either to ADA or to the project itself if it was issued as a revenue bond. The use of a limited liability company, or LLC, to effectuate a development project would mean that that anyone seeking recourse would go against the assets first of the LLC, and then would then have to show there was some ability to go beyond that, which is commonly called with a corporation piercing the corporate veil. Usually, if a LLC goes bankrupt, the assets are those of the LLC. What we're seeking to do is actually be able to coordinate with other investors and leverage our funds. And as we looked at percentages of a project to try to say, we'll put in half the money, the developers that came to us said, well, we need to have some legal structure to work with you. And the proposal is using an LLC. So that LLC would be the same as any other limited liability company that's out there in the market. And our intention is to work with other investors. And, of course, there would also be insurance using our LLC. So there'd be various pots of money available to potential creditors.
The only problem I have with this explanation is a fish plant that sits out in my district that was financed substantially by state funds and basically went through exactly that same process. And I forget what it cost the state of Alaska.
Representative Dugan, through the chair, the fish plant cost approximately $50 million.
Right.
And was has been liquidated. I think that's exactly why we're asking for this legislation. I'm glad you raised that. The reason to seek private partners in a development project is to seek whether someone else is interested in that industry, whether other people who have their own capital at risk think that whatever you're building, fish plant or whatever, would make money and have a return. We're required by statute to make a return. So by working through an LLC structure, I think we would be looking for those partners. I would posit to you that there were probably not sufficient partners for the seafood plant, and that was one reason why it was not successful.
Right. All I'm trying to do is nail down the question of whether or not, based on that experience, the legislation with regard to the LLCs is actually going to require participation by private persons, or is it still going to be possible under this structure for ADA or some combination of ADA and other public funds to venture into these kinds of operations?
President, speaking through the chair, ADA under this statute can still build a development finance project by itself, but we've also shared a strategic plan which calls for us to try to work with private capital. The proposal here is to allow us to do an LLC so that when we own a percentage of a project with other private capital, we do so through a structure. And certainly the aim of the agency is to try to leverage our funds to do the most we can. And this proposal, I think, is going in the direction that you want it to go in versus ADA developing things by itself.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. But people who run ADA come and go, just like politicians come and go. And what I'm trying to be sure is that there is not an eventuality in which we are incapable of either making the same mistakes that we made there or making enhanced mistakes by introducing other financial structures into this. But I don't think you're offering me that there, because it seems to me that what you're telling me is, yeah, we can do it, but we don't want to. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, Representative Chair, I think you have to look at the financial picture that you might be facing. For example, if you had a small development project with new technology that was that didn't attract investors but didn't cost very much, the board could consider whether it wanted to put some cash into that technology for the good of the economy. That would be a board decision. As you go up to the level of risk and the amount of investment, I think it's prudent to use another legal vehicle, such as either a corporation or an LLC, and also to have partners with you. So I think that your safety valve is in the board. It was kind of a seven-member board, and that by giving, if the legislature agrees, by giving us this tool, we can mitigate risk, increase leverage, and achieve, I think, the results we're trying to get to.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Brought up the fish plant, seemingly an illegitimate child, but they probably have a whole file full of drawers from legislators demanding you do something on that from back in the 90s, but that's probably another subject. Representative Edgman, Representative Jewell, and Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions, actually, if I may. My first question is this bill, I don't know what time is in essence of here, but I'll get to the main point. Apparently, you can create as many LLCs as you want, but envisioning a private-public partnership, imagining an LLC is the beauty of an LLC is you don't the board as a whole can be the board of directors for the LLC, right? A board itself. So, assuming you set up a partnership with a private entity, is it envisioned that the ADA board will always be the board of directors? I don't see that anywhere here in the bill.
No, Representative Edgman, through the chair, a limited liability company can be organized so that the members are in control or the members can elect a managing partner, and then the members are more passive investors. Usually, I think the way this would work with ADA, it would be more of a passive investor, and you would elect a managing member from the private sector with expertise in whatever you're trying to build or run. That they would tend to operate the LLC. However, given corporate governance, the members could put restraints on the managing member, on how much could be spent, what could be done, and any organic change to the structure, that is a major structure, would have to have the vote of all the members.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'll leave it there.
Be incomplete not to have Representative Jewell. A lot of folks say their project benefited from ADA. I think his region created ADA. So, Representative Jewell.
I wasn't actually going to even talk about the Red Dog Dillon transportation system. However, since you brought it up, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm not. The economy across the country is kind of, in question, and Alaska seems to be one of those states that's in good financial position, and I'm wondering if that strong position is a little bit a driver in trying to expand the base because you have different, I'm thinking about the military and coastal possibly infrastructure that may need to happen either through the Department of Defense or other things as we pursue that line. And I'm just wondering if our financial position is a place that different kinds, in addition to governments, federal governments, but other kinds of business, are looking to Alaska as a place to that's a good risk to do business, I guess. Is.
Representative Jewell, to the chair, yes, I think it's a good question. You're right. Just two quick anecdotes. We floated some bonds in December for $60 million, and I received calls myself from brokers in several other states that were interested. The reason is ADA's bonds are at a AA, a little better. Those are pretty rare right now. So you're right, there is interest outside in Alaska. Secondly, we've been in contact with a New York bank last week that had never done any business with us, and now they're thinking perhaps about doing that, which demonstrates again that if you're looking at the national landscape, Alaska is a fairly good place to do some business.
Representative Thomas. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions. The LLC, if let's say I have a gold mine down here, and I can't afford to build a road, but I can work through ADA and help finance that road as an LLC, are you part owner of the mine or what?
Representative Thomas, to the chair, we'd have to look at the structure that makes sense for that project. This bill would give us more tools than we have now, but it might be that you'd want it structured the way Red Dog is now, where the agency might control and own the road, because that lets it be a public road. In certain instances, there would be a good state policy to have a public road. Other instances, though, you might want to share the risk of the entire project, and that would be kind of a financial decision that we have to make internally. What this bill does is give us the flexibility to make that correct decision for public policy and financial reasons.
Okay, because that's probably the only thing that you could have said that would have, might have scared me, because of what Representative Dugan pointed out, is that there's always political monsters in the closet that have a goal to a mine or a road to a mine, and we can convince you that it's good public policy to build that road 40 miles, go west, my son, 40 miles, good public policy. But you didn't know, you may not know that about 22 miles down the road, you can go right by my mine, and that'll spur off for a mile where I couldn't afford to build it otherwise, because it's $200 million or $180 million for the road. But I'm not gonna hold you, Philip. I just wanted to make a point that.
No, I think Representative, that's a good question. I think that what you should be doing is looking for a return. And so if we build a road where various people use it, we have to figure out a mechanism for those people that contribute to the cost consistent with what we're helping them with.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, that people will be honest with you, because I could see roads in Alaska being built to resources, and we pay for it, and we get nothing back. And I think those members in here think that the mineral royalties are kind of low, so we're going to go out there and build road favors, I guess I'd call it. That's what scares me, is that could happen. And hopefully this instrument won't be used.
Well, Representative Thomas, through the chair, that's a good question. If we bond a road, then the indenture of the bond required to be repaid,
right.
And we have to be convinced that road can pay those bonds, or we're not going to build that road.
Well, I like this up front rather than DOT building a road somewhere, and then really the golden goose is a mine sitting at the other end or halfway through, and I know Mike knows who I'm talking about, so I'm done with that conversation. Thanks.
Representative Gettenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly can see lots of good things coming out of being able to do this, but one question I have is in conflict with existing planning processes, whether it would be DOT, the statewide STIP, or a local community, or anything else. You know, does anything in here require you to be in consultation with that, or could you skip over somebody else's or ignore a statewide planning process, whether it's energy projects, road, or anything else?
President Goodman, through the chair, there are three constraints. The first is that if a bond is issued for over $6 million, any large project today is probably going to be over that amount. We are required already by statute to consult with and obtain the consent of the local government in that area, or if there's no local government, of the equivalent, that is to go out and talk to those people and make sure they agree. Secondly, of course, we'd have to have the board of ADA agree with the project. And they meet in a public process, and they take testimony, and often people do come and tell us what they think. And thirdly, there's the constraint on the bond market, that the people that might want to buy these bonds or issue these bonds would have one thing they want to know, is there support for this, and is it contrary to any other plans? Because if that's the case, then the bond market will react negatively.
You said those things before. I just wanted to hear them again in that context. Thank you.
The question I was when he asked if it would bypass a planning process, I got kind of excited about a possible answer.
Representative Dugan. Sorry, Mr. Fairness, to take two bites off the apple, but I just realized I had a note here that didn't make any sense to me, and I was hoping that the gentleman who testified could do that, because at one point you were talking about financing roads, and you said, you know, you have roads like the one to Red Dog, and then you said, or you might have a road that might not line up.
Yeah.
Could you explain that to me?
Sure. Representative, the chair, I apologize for any inarticulate on my behalf. What I meant was the Red Dog mine is connected directly to the Long Mountain Transportation System, so that road supports a specific development project. If you had a road that was supporting, say, an oil area for more drilling, But the that the road itself did not connect directly to each rig, then the question raised now under the current statutes, even if you had a mechanism to pay for the road, is whether that non-connection to the rig would allow ADA to build it.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other questions, is there any lingering discomfort with this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there is. But I've learned to live with it.
Okay. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I make a motion to move from committee to CS for House Bill 119 EDT 27-GH1745-M from committee with attached fiscal notes and any individual committee recommendations.
Hearing no objections, the bill advances out of this committee. Please stay around and sign the reports. Thank you, everybody, for staying past when you may have had other conflicting meetings. Appreciate being able to at least move a couple of bills out today. So with that, go chair.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, our next scheduled meeting is Thursday, 1:30, and bills previously heard are scheduled. We have two HB7, HB19 scheduled so far. So with that, adjourned.